It'll go fairly quickly as we move through this, but let's just do a little bit of review. We'll just talk about last week, if any of you weren't here, because I want to make sure that every one of us has some exposure to all of these six stories. So the story that we talked about last week was what we call the disconnected story. The disconnected story is a story that has a beginning, it has an end, and for one of two reasons that I suggested, it becomes disconnected. The first reason that a disconnected story becomes disconnected is because it was not told properly. It's the "you can't get there from here" story. And in that, you create some sort of a happily ever after or ideal scenario for the ending. This is where I'm going to go. These are the good things that I'm going to experience. But the beginning doesn't launch you toward that end. And so he said, you get all emotionally excited about what's in the present. And in the process of being in the present, you tell yourself that the present can take you to a future, and it's impossible that you can follow that course and get to that outcome. But we said that there was a second, and perhaps for many of us, it's the more challenging way in which we can end up in a disconnected story. And in that version of the story, I begin well, but there was a phrase that we used that ultimately describes this. The power or the draw of the present obscures the possibility for the future. And what I meant by that is you become so fascinated with something in the present, a distraction, a temptation, an allure. And they're not all bad. It's just that once you're distracted, you lose sight of and can't get to the final outcome that you'd hoped for. And remember we used two people last week. For the first version of the story, we used the young teenage mom. I assume she was a teenage mom. The mom who I said I projected onto her some assumptions when I saw her in an inner city street. And I said, you know, no one wants to wake up in the morning. No one says I'm going to mess up my life. I'm going to spend years planning how I can screw it up. It's just that because they didn't think through all of the middle. Remember we said the middle is where we live. The middle is where we are prone to weakness. The middle is today, and the middle is where we all struggle. We don't struggle in the past. Every one of us inside our head has a perfect future that we've created. Just to give you an example, have you ever lost an argument with yourself?
Well, yeah.
But in the process of being drawn towards something, we let the other slip away. And remember we said the example that we used for the second story, the second version of that story, was Achan. And we said that Achan had a promising future that he had lived toward, he had been promised, and he was hoping to experience. Right? He experienced the miracles of God. He experienced crossing the Jordan. He experienced the ceremonial commitment of his people. He experienced all of that, and he knew that following God was serious business and that God was serious about his business. And yet one temptation lured him away. But we said it wasn't a simple temptation. And if you weren't here or you don't remember the story, remember every one of the fighting men was told that everything within the confines of the city of Jericho was off limits to them. It was dedicated to God or dedicated to destruction. One of those two options. And Achan saw something and he wanted it. But it wasn't just something. And this is the part when we read the story quickly that we don't grasp. That this was the possibility to short-circuit or to shortchange the long process of getting to a good outcome, because what Achan saw and Achan took was the equivalent, we said last week, of what a typical man would earn in his entire lifetime. And so in one moment, Achan told himself a story that somehow God won't notice or God won't care or no one else will notice, and I'll be able to get the good outcome that I want, but without all the difficulty of going the hard way. And if you recall, I suggest that there was one other thing that every one of us is tempted toward and may at one time or another tell a disconnected story. Here's the thing. You cannot get distracted in the middle and not bring consequences on other people. It is impossible to tell a disconnected story and not have some of the repercussions, some of the ramifications spill over onto other people whom you have chosen to involve in your story. And so even if for the sake of, or even if you don't care about yourself, simply for the sake of the people whom you have invited to be part of your story, you owe it to yourself to think carefully about how you live in the middle. All right. Every week we're doing a little bit. Oh, are there any questions, any interaction before we move on? Probably not, because it's review. Okay. So every week we're doing a little bit of theory on story. We've covered a lot so far. If anyone did not get notes from the first couple of weeks and would like them, see me afterwards and I'll try to get you some notes. If I've promised you notes that you've asked for before and I have forgotten, that's not unusual. Let's just say that. You would have attached one, but you probably didn't get the copy from last week, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
This week's email.
Well, then you don't need it. Just look for Jason's email. You should have it.
He did. Good job.
Yep. All right. So the first story theory that we're going to look at today is what I'm calling risk versus danger. And I think this is a particularly profound concept that we all get hooked on. There are those things that feel dangerous to us, but when carefully executed, actually have very little prospect of danger. So I'm using, and you may push back on this one a little bit, but I'm using the illustration of skydiving. Okay, now skydiving feels, just feels, inherently dangerous. Right? It just does. And yet, if a person is careful, checks their gear, has the backup chute, has received the proper training, and does things well, there's a very low risk. There's a manageable risk, even though it feels horribly dangerous to jump out of a plane. But are there things that in the moment feel reasonably safe and yet carry with them far higher consequences, even though our feelings suggest that they're really not all that dangerous? As we tell story, let's not trust our emotions only. Because our emotions sometimes suggest to us that things that are dangerous aren't, and things that aren't dangerous are. You and I cannot live a great story without some risk. Remember last week, and I will double back a little bit to look at one component that we said, which is the tension that occurs during the far end of the planning phase. So remember what we said, the greatest amount of tension exists at the moment before we actually start to act. That every great story has a moment where all the planning must come to a culmination. I can't repeat the planning. I can't double down on the planning. If I am going to tell a great story, there must be a moment somewhere where I move from planning to action, and it is at that moment that I am going to experience the most tension, the most nervousness, and where I'm also going to be tempted not to act. And I said last week that, you know, you see that in great movies. Even if they're movies of crime, right? The great bank robbery. Well, there's months or even years of planning goes into something, but there has to be a moment of no return. We need to become comfortable with moments of no return. And because that's true, we need to be able to understand and distinguish between genuine danger that might feel safe and reasonable risk that might at the moment feel extremely dangerous. Any questions? Are we good on that? All right. Which deserves doubling back to the first week when we introduced the concepts of unholy or holy or holy to God. And I suggested in week one that there was a primary collection of reasons why it was valuable for us to be holy to God. We said that if I'm unholy, I have no barriers, no firewall, and I am one with the collective mass, and therefore I really don't make any decisions myself. I just follow what the masses say. We said then that I can become holy, which means I put partitions and firewalls into my life. I am set apart. I am separate from. But we also suggested that the danger there is that I am not really, honestly, when I'm truthful with myself, I am not well equipped to make my own decisions unguided. That I can make bad choices, and every one of us has experienced that. And so we said that the safest place to be is holy to God for four particular reasons. And I'm repeating this because I want you, as you listen to today's material, to weave this understanding into the new material. So what were the four reasons that we suggested that God was, we'll call him, trustworthy and deserved our separation to him? There were four components. I said, God is these four things, and therefore we can trust him. We can be separate to him. Anybody remember any of them? What's that?
The last one was love.
The last one was love. God is loving. We'll come back to that because the first couple need to be introduced first. It says, God knows enough. Right? How many of you feel that you know enough to make all the decisions in your life? We said, God knows enough. But beyond that, have you ever had all the knowledge necessary but not an understanding about how to use the knowledge? Of course. So we said God knows enough and God understands enough. And the third component was God is reliable. That means he's consistent. He's constant. He's not going to change over time. And that means that he can guide us if we trust him. If we trust him, he can guide us to do the right thing consistently. The counter to that is this. You and I sometimes know enough, understand enough, and yet still don't make the right choice. Why? Whatever it is. And so sometimes we've suggested that we're not reliable enough to rely on ourselves only. And that brings us to the next thing, the last thing that everybody wants to know. And Vinny said it, God is loving, and what does that mean? He's going to act in our best interest. See, he could know enough, he could understand enough, he could be reliable in terms of him being consistent, and yet if we could not live secure in the fact that he loved us, we couldn't be positive that he actually had our best interest at heart. But because of those four components woven together, we said that holiness to God is the best place to be when it comes to telling great story. All right. Now, with all that said, again, a little bit of review, but now this starts to bring us into the current tense. We said that story is composed of four elements. The first is me. I am part of story. And even if I don't consider myself to be the central figure in my own story, I'm still part of it. Anybody remember the other three components to story?
Your history.
Your history is the compilation of all that that's on that timeline. Let me just quickly show that to who hasn't been here. Paul hasn't been here. Is there anybody else who hasn't been here? You haven't? Okay. All right, most of you have seen this. Let's try another marker. Maybe the next one. Let's use pink. Why not? Okay, so we said that this is our past, this is our future, and this line right there represents our present. Our present is always moving. Our present is this razor thin, as I've said again and again, slice of time that is now. And what John said is that our history, which is our past, we said, is the foundation on which we build the understandings and which we move into our future. But we said the present is that moment in time where we interpret our history and choose how to use it or how to bend it to get to a better future. All right, so all that to say, no, history isn't the right answer. But, okay, the four components. So the first is me. The second is the people I surround myself with. You cannot tell a great story and have no one else in the story. The third component is time. Remember last week we had the discussion with Jim, where Jim told us about him wanting to be a bike racer, and yet he realized that he was a little past that season. It was an understanding of his time in life, and yet he still wanted to be involved with motorcycles, and he said he could still become a great mechanic and in that way become involved in the motorcycle industry. Right? So myself, the people I surround myself with, my timing, where I am in my own timeline, but also where I am in terms of human history, human understanding, and what was the fourth one? My circumstances and situations. That I can't tell a story about my future that ignores where I am, with whom I am, and the conditions that exist in that present. As a matter of fact, if I don't address the conditions that are present, I'll tell a work of fiction. And if I do want to tell a great story, and I'll just give you a little bit of information about where we're headed. One of the things that we're going to say is that a great story is going to involve contributing to multiple generations. And so if I want to tell a story ultimately that contributes to multiple generations, I need to understand the circumstances and the situations of my present. Why? Okay, doesn't a great story somehow change the future? Remember we said that last week? That most of us as believers are uncomfortable to talk about changing the future, but none of us is uncomfortable with saying, let's make history. All great stories want to write a better future. So I need to know better than what? Therefore, I need to know better than the situations and circumstances that exist today. I can't tell a great story unless I know what I would like to change or influence about the future, because all story is lived futureward. Okay. Three types of people that I'm going to want. Remember, every week we're looking at a little bit more of tying all this together. Three distinct types of people that I'm going to want in my story. I gave you some homework last week. Did anybody do any of that homework? There were four things. I asked you to look at one question about each of those four components. The first is, who do I need to become in order to be the right person to live in the story I've told about my future? See, if I arrive at my future and the situations are right, but I'm not the right person, it's not going to be the story I hope for. So what? The first question was, who do I need to become to be the man who is qualified to step into that future that I hope to experience? The second one is, who are the people that I need with me? Who are the types of people? And if they are not currently in my life, where will I find them? And today we're going to look at three types, and that's why I was asking if any of you did the homework. I assume based on the rather confused looks, that I'll take that all to be, no, I didn't. Is that safe? Okay then, it's very good. Okay, three types of people. People who can give great counsel and people who will give varied counsel. That's the first type. So we all, or many of us, will surround ourselves with people that will give us counsel. The danger is that typically we surround ourselves with people that we agree with. Why?
It's comfortable.
It's comfortable. It's easy. And after all, who wants to be in disagreement with people? But if you surround yourself with people that agree with you, what are you likely to get?
You're going to get yourself whatever you want.
Yeah, you're going to get yourself and you're going to get whatever you want because everybody pretty much agrees with you. You're going to get different variations of yourself. So as uncomfortable as this is, if you want to write a better story for your future, you're going to have some people in your life who are not like you and who don't think like you and can offer you some perspective. Right, the second kind of people you want some people that you want to be with. Right, you want people to have fun with. You want people to laugh with. You want people that are both serious and you can have fellowship with them at a deep level, but you want people that you can enjoy a sunset with or a sunrise with. You want people that do share some of your interests, so you can talk about a movie or a book together. Why? Because if all of your life is about output and you never experience the joy of it, then it wasn't really a great life after all. So you want people to give you counsel. You want people to share life with. And the third part, you want people that can add to your story because they know things or know people or can bring things to the story that you simply don't have access to. Now, if they weren't people, we'd call them resources, but they're people, so we can't just call them resources. But we do need resource people. Because if you're enough, if you're all the resources you need, then your story isn't going to be very big. So, point of question now, given that those are at very least the three types of people that I need to surround myself with to tell a better story, how are you doing? Do you have a council of people that you interact with regularly, some of whom do not see life the way you do, and bring something different to it? Do you have people that you enjoy being with? Most of us do. That's usually not the hard part. But thirdly, are you building connection with people that can add something to your story that you simply don't have now? So let's take a look at Vinny for a minute. So Vinny's in a ministry. He works with people that have challenges. Would that be a safe way to say it? I think that would be polite, right? Vinny works with people who have challenges. Now, I'll bet there are days when Vinny doesn't feel adequate in and of himself to provide everything that his ministry and those people need. Is that safe to say? And so there are probably times when Vinny thinks to himself, boy, I wish we had A, or boy, I wish I had A, or boy, I wish we knew someone who could. Am I accurate? Okay, and so what Vinny is saying at that moment is there are resource people that I long for in order to be able to complete this story that I'm starting to tell myself about the future. All right, let's take a look at this in a very practical sense. Immediately below that list of three people, there's a text here from 1 Kings. Then Nathan asked Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king, and our Lord David knows nothing about it? Okay, so just to give you a little bit of backstory on this, for in case you don't know, David is very old. He's we'll say, in his last days, and it looks as if one of his sons is going to do an end run around his plans to have Solomon crowned as the next king, as his successor. And so while David is, if you will, on his deathbed, another son plans how he's going to become king and actually commits to that process. And so Nathan discovers this because they're celebrating this other son's coronation. Okay, so here's what Nathan says. If you listen to me, now this is profound, this is his statement. If you listen to me, you'll save your life and the life of your son Solomon. So at this moment, what's being said is that all of David's legacy plans hinge on one person. And David doesn't even know that all of his plans hinge on this one person right now. Nor does Bathsheba, who was in on the plan. And it's her son. And so the people that are most have the most at stake aren't even aware of what's going on. Now let me ask you this. Are there people that literally have your back? We use that phrase all the time. What does it mean? What does it mean to have someone's back?
Looking out for you.
Looking out for you, but why did the original crafters of that phrase use it?
People sneak up behind you.
Yeah. People sneak up behind you. You cannot see behind you. When you were young, you probably thought your mom could, but it really wasn't true. She just knew some stuff about you. We can't see what's coming up behind us. Do you actually have someone who's watching out for the parts in your life that you are blind to? And this is what this dear friend Nathan is. And if you know much about Nathan, you know that before he had to already confront King David. So Nathan wasn't always the bringer of glad tidings, but in this case, he loves David. He wants David's plans to prosper. So this is what he says, if you listen to me, you'll save your life and the life of your son, Solomon. So, Why do you suppose he says to Bathsheba, you'll save your own life? Bathsheba is the mom of Solomon. Solomon is to be king, but someone has done what I said is that end run around Adonijah, and he has appointed himself king, and has plenty of people that are supporting that, including priests and military men. Why is Bathsheba's life at stake here?
Well, if he becomes king, she's going to be taken out. She'll be killed. Yeah.
She'll be a threat. Solomon will be a threat. And they'll ultimately be taken out. We don't even think that way when we read something like this, because as gruesome as our own political system is, it hasn't quite come to that yet. Who knows? Well,
there's a few conspiracies.
Glenn, also in that time, when the tradition to do that, whoever was a threat to whoever wanted to rise as king, they would just take out even everyone in their family.
Sure. All right, so, this is the great part. I can't remember who it is right now, but there's that company that has the commercials about, oh, we don't actually come fix your stuff, we just tell you it's broken. I wish I could remember. Huh? Is that what it is? Okay, that's what it is. Well, aren't we glad that Nathan, or isn't Bathsheba at least, glad that Nathan isn't just the person pointing out the problem? Say, have you heard what's happening in the other end of town? One of David's other sons is becoming king. And can't we see the scenario? And Bathsheba says, well, what should we do about it? And Nathan says, well, I don't know. I just came to tell you what's happening. Nathan is a good friend. Nathan not only is aware of what's happening, but Nathan has a plan. And I'll just read it for you quickly. Go unto King David and say to him, my lord the king, did you not swear to me, your servant, surely Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Why then has Adonijah become king? And immediately after that, if you were to read on in the text, immediately after that, it says that Naaman himself comes in. All right. This is a reflection question right now. Do you have people of that caliber and quality in your life? Because your story might never come about. Do you realize how close this was to Solomon not having a history? Let's not minimize this, because this was the Bible and this was all going to go us. Let's not minimize that. There were some pretty cutthroat, nasty people throughout the kingdoms of Judea and Israel. There were some pretty nasty people. All right. Questions or comments before we move on?
You think of the contributions that Solomon made scripturally and for the legacy he built based on Proverbs and Song of Solomon. All of that could have ended here had they not listened to somebody outside the circle. How often do we push people away because their stuff doesn't make sense? Even for Bathsheba to go to King David and say that, didn't you not swear to me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did swear to her. That's why she knew she could go and say that. But if she had relied on just the one resource and not the other, she never would have bonded David.
And let's not minimize the fact that I know you think that this is like, well, it's just husband and wife. Let's look at how she addresses him. Go to King David and say to him, my lord the king. All right, now I know many of us wish our wives would come into the living room and refer to us as that, but that probably hasn't in your life, and I wouldn't look for it to happen anytime soon.
Well, part of the problem was too many wives, too many children. You know, that's why that son could try to gain the support to become king. It wasn't like he had three sons, you know, too many, distant, no relationship.
All right. One final point before we move on. We've said that, and this is sort of review, but sort of new. We said that planning is essential, but no matter how well we plan to tell a great story, there are going to be surprises come into our lives. We're all in agreement about that, I'm sure. Maybe within the last week you've had a surprise come into your life. It didn't fit the script that you told yourself about how your week was going to go. And incidentally, I think I have emphasized this clearly, but just from listening to some people in the Wednesday night group, I've sensed that they're looking at story more as what I'm telling myself about what's going to happen in the next moment. Now, that's true. It's true that you want to rehearse or have a story about how you hope a relationship confrontation or discussion is going to go. But I'm thinking about a much longer time frame, so I hope that we all embrace that. So coming back to the idea of planning, what do we do with the unexpected that comes into our life that doesn't fit our plan? Okay, and while you're mulling that over and thinking about it, consider this. That if you don't have a detailed plan for how you hope the story will go, you can't recognize a great opportunity as being anything but an inconvenience or an accident. Look at that. Paul said several weeks ago that he was teachable, and apparently he truly is. Thank you, Paul. And I'm going to shut up before he doesn't bring me my coffee back. Think about that. If you don't have a great plan, you will probably be blinded to the opportunities that could be there. But if you do have a good plan and a bias to action, when some new thing comes into your life, you may recognize it for what it could be instead of as something that gets in the way of the tightly reined-in script that you have. Okay, so we're off of review. Paul, thank you very much. And we're on to story number two, which I'm calling the exception story. So the first story, the disconnected story. I want you to remember these because I believe every single human being is prone to these kinds of storytelling. The exception story. My life will be different. We'll just read it. I won't end up that or become that because I'm different and unique. The exception story has numerous variations, but at its heart is this one ingredient. I am different in ways which makes me an exception to the normal rules and possibilities of life. And then these 4 points. I'm either better than and above things which might bring down weaker persons. Let's just stop right there. Again, I'll single out Vinny. Has anyone ever come to you and said, I thought I could handle this? Whether it was alcohol or drugs. It might have snagged other people, but I had this under control in my own life. Has anyone ever suggested that that might be true to you? Okay, what's that? That's the exception story. I'm stronger than, bigger than, better than, unique in some way, and therefore that disqualifies me from things that might be true of lesser people. Now, it can go the other way around. Understand that. You'll see that in a minute. The exception story can also play out through any of the other three elements of the story. So it's not just what you tell yourself about yourself, it's what you tell yourself about the people around you. I said the exception story could work in the reverse. That means that you might be more disadvantaged, more incapable, have all the odds stacked against you. That's why I said we need to remember the 4 components of story. My circumstances and situations are so horrendous compared to everyone else's that while everybody else might be able to tell a great story about their future, I can't because my situation is uniquely dire. Now, I exaggerate. But at what level have you ever used your disadvantage as an excuse for why you couldn't tell a better story for the future? All right. I love this one. I was born at the wrong time. I remember thinking that for most of my adult life, honestly. Like, I wish I had been born 200 years earlier. It seems like it might have been a fun time to live. There was plenty of land to explore. You could just go traipsing across the country and explore things, and it seemed like it might be a fun time. Now, admittedly, I discount all the hardships of that and the Indians and the wild bears and all that. It just sounds cool. And here I am stuck in 21st century America. All right. Can you see how, and I want you to take a serious inventory, can you see how when you begin to tell this exception story, and you weave it in with the four components of story, that you can tell yourself an exceedingly great whopper of a tale about what you can avoid or what you can't become. And we're going to look at how this plays out with a couple of people in the scripture in a few minutes. All right. Am I telling an exception story? Here are a few of the telltale indicators. This kind of thing has never happened to anyone else. Or if it has, they've never been able to recover, and they too have all had an equally bad story. I was just meeting with a young lady last night. She works at the Starbucks, and she just a number of times I went in there, and she looked particularly down. And she got to talking to me a little bit across the counter, and I said, hey, would you like to just sit down sometime over a cup of coffee? Starbucks seemed like the natural place to do that. So last night we had coffee there, and she told me a little bit about her story. And all I could think of for the first 20 minutes of her telling me about her story, and she's just turned 18, and all I could think of is, if you can recover from that story, you can recover from anything. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but both mom and dad, heavily involved in drugs, asked to go to her grandparents in Florida. They're from up here. Asked to go to her grandparents in Florida and spend years down there. The grandparents really don't want her or like her. The grandparents themselves don't get along with each other. Finally, the grandparents kick her out and send her back up to Pennsylvania to stay with her father. Remember the addict? To stay with her father because... And the people in Florida agree with this. The children and youth people in Florida actually agree with this, and they actually acknowledge that maybe it would be better for her to stay with her drug addict father in Pennsylvania than it was to live in the condition she was living in Florida. And she goes on to tell me a little bit more about the last couple of years of her life and how she started to put things on track again, but how sometimes she gets a little bit despondent or depressed about life. And I thought, well, that's perfectly understandable given the story that you've just told me. Here's my point. If a girl can start to tell a better story from that place in her life with that background, I'm pretty confident that any one of us can begin to tell a great story no matter what's going on in our life before. Remember that line we said? The present is the point in my life where I take all of my history, I interpret that history, and I make a choice to bend that to create a better future. But if I waste this moment, I just push it further and further and further along. And the more that I push back out into the future, the more history of despondency I amass, and the more history of despondency and I can't and I won't and I'm different, the more of that history that I amass, the greater the foundation of I can't I've built on which to build the rest of my life. And there was another phrase I used in the first week when I used this illustration. I said, if you want to have a better past, you need to begin today. If I want to have a better past, I need to start today to create the history that will become the better past on which I'll build my future. All right, the next possible one. And remember, this is personal inventory. And don't look at the extremes. Look at small and subtle ways in which you might be telling yourself this story. My misery, and yes, misery is misspelled. I thank you for observing that if you did. My misery or despair is uniquely traumatic and paralyzing. This particular version of the exception is often generational. In other words, it's my family's lot in life to be this. We're just common folk. We never amount to very much. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard people talk like that, but I have. We're just ordinary people, and we do ordinary things. And nothing great ever comes from our kind of people. I don't care where you're from, you make the choices about who you will become. Yes, that might happen to other people who are engaged in that sort of thing, but I'm different. That won't happen to me. I'm smarter, more careful, more skilled, more alert. And finally, if you knew the things going on in my life, the people I live with, the bad circumstances I've had to endure, you'd understand. The reason you don't understand why I'm unique is because you've never had anything like this happen to you. Now, just think about this. How much do you actually know about everyone's story in this room? We make a lot of generalizations about how people could not have had difficult pasts based on what they look like today. Have you ever heard a testimony from someone and it just shocked you when you found out the whole story?
Sure.
And yet you thought, wow, it looks like they've had a really great life, maybe even an easy life. Absolutely none of us is exempt from difficulties in life. All right. Questions before we move on. Let me just read this then. We're going to go on to the third page, which is a single-sided page for you. We're not born exceptions or born into exceptions. Instead, we create exceptions. It is true that there are exceptions to every generality. Michael Phelps is in some ways a born swimmer, an exception. But it's not just or even mostly his natural endowments which have made him a great swimmer. It is, or it was, his tenacious commitment to the process that has taken him to greatness. He has made himself different. Now there's the key phrase. Your circumstances don't make you different. Your birth doesn't make you different. Your choices about who you will become are what will ultimately make you different. In some ways, by making himself abnormal in his commitment to training and the singular focus of that, any competitive athlete believes that he can become the exception. All right, I'm not going to read on. We'll just evaluate this. Every single competitive athlete believes that they can become the exception. How do we know that? Well, let me ask you this. Why else would you compete if you were a competitor if it wasn't to win? Right? And I use here the example of the Olympics, but how many people medal in the Olympics in any event? Yeah, it's not a trick question. How many people compete? A lot sometimes. What compels people to endure the hardship, the difficulty, the waking up early or going to bed late, whatever it takes to get the training in, the financial sacrifice of parents? What compels them to do that?
They believe and think it's happening.
Yes. Bill.
You see that a lot in professional athletes' career. For example, let's put a silly one, say Ryan Howard. Why do so many of these guys that have had such a successful career put it to limits at the end of their career and refuse to give it up? They all believe they're the exception. They could have thought it would matter how they would get. That seems to play itself over and over again. They really are no different. They're all very similar.
What I want you to take away from this is that an exception is not who you were born into. An exception is what you become in a great way or a bad way by what you allow yourself to think. All right, now, do you see why being holy to God matters? The knowledge, the understanding, the reliability, and the love. You can consult God, you can ask God, what is the good plan that he has that he wants to write with you? And what is believable for your life? Which brings us to another one of those points of review. We said that when it comes to telling great story, there's what's inevitable, there's what's probable, there's what's possible. And we'll stop there before we get to the last two. So we said inevitable is what fate-based people assume. They assume that because this is the situation now, that is the logical and only outcome. Have you ever been in an almost accident? The kind where the tires squeal and the car's going sideways, your heart's up around here, and you're pretty sure that you're going to touch that bumper or something bigger in the next half a second. Have you ever been there? Why do you keep pushing your foot on the brake and trying to steer or counter-steer? Because the crash is inevitable? No, because you believe there might be an alternative outcome. Okay, we do that instinctively when it comes to an accident, but yet I think many of us just settle for what's inevitable or what's probable in the rest of our lives. What if you pursued something with the same level of passion that you pursue putting your foot on the brake in advance of an accident? And I know what you're thinking. Well, that's an insane level of commitment. How bad do you want to tell a good story? Just think about that. An illustration from everyday life. How many of you are parents? How many of you are parents? Not how many of you have parents. I didn't. Yes, you are parents. Okay. Now, for those of us who are parents, did your kids ever come to you and say something to the effect of, well, that's not going to happen to me?
No.
Right? Has anyone had that experience as a parent?
Yeah.
Now, if everyone believes that they are the exception to the rule, why does almost everyone have the same story about what's not going to happen to them? Just think about that. What I'm saying is we all somehow have deluded ourselves into believing that we're all the exception to the rule, and the normal things that happen to other people or the great things that could happen to us are impossible for us because we're all somehow unique. And here's what I want to remind us all. We all feel unique because we're having a unique human experience. What goes on inside your head is unique, for good or for bad. I don't know what goes on inside your head, but what goes on inside your head is unique. And you can have your own opinions about your reality. You just can't have your own facts about your reality that are divorced from reality. And the mere fact that everyone thinks that they're somehow unique basically disproves that theory that they are unique in the fact that they can't, that they are the exception to the rule. Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do now. Let's turn over to... well, let's start in 2 Chronicles. Second Chronicles, we're going to go to the first chapter. We're just doing a little bit of background here because I'd like you to notice a couple of things. Solomon the son of David established himself in his kingdom, and the Lord his God was with him and made him exceedingly great. Solomon spoke to all Israel, so the commanders of thousands and of hundreds and the judges and to all the leaders in all Israel, the heads of the fathers' houses, and Solomon and all the assembly with him went up to the high place that was in Gibeon. For the tent of meeting of God, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, had made in the wilderness, was there. There's an interesting thing that kind of like slips by our notice sometimes. So down here is Jerusalem, and up here is Gibeon. So, at another point that we're going to look at, it says that the... can't even think of it. The chest that the priests carry. There we go. The Ark of the Covenant. Is that the first signs of old age? The Ark of the Covenant is housed in a tent in Jerusalem. And yet the tent of meeting... and remember, the two of these are ideally... they're supposed to be paired. They're to be together. But the tent of meeting is way up here. Now, how does the Ark of the Covenant get here? Well, because during the reign of Saul, it was taken out in battle and it was captured. And so David makes the commitment to bring it back to Jerusalem. And that's a whole long story that we don't have time for right now. But anyway, the Ark of the Covenant finds itself in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the tent of meeting finds itself up here, some miles north of Jerusalem. There's some symbolism here. So the tent is the place where people go to meet God. The covenant is symbolic of the live and active presence on site of God. Right? So I go to this to meet God, but this is where God is when we take God with us. That's why you saw the Ark of the Covenant was the point in the middle of the stream, in the middle of the Jordan, when the people passed it. It was God's presence in that moment. The Ark of the Covenant is carried through the desert. The Ark of the Covenant goes with them to important places. But when the people went to meet with God, they went to this separate place. They're going to be united again, but they're not united at this point in time. 1 Kings 8. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes and the leaders of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel before King Solomon in Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion, and all the men assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month of Ithian, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the Ark, and they brought up the Ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels. So here's what's happened. Sometime in advance of the completion of the temple, Solomon has enough wisdom to understand, well, we need to unite all this, so we're going to go get the tent of meeting and also the altar that is part of the tent of meeting, and we're going to bring that down and we're going to store it in Jerusalem. And then when the temple is done, we will unite everything, both the ark and the tent, inside the temple. Then the priest brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place underneath the wings of the cherubim, for the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the Ark. The Lord, I'm just jumping down a little bit. The Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And when the priest came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So it says that it took Solomon 7 years. Solomon and all the workmen and everything, it took them 7 years to build this temple. 7 years he plans and constructs for the completion of this temple. Big deal to him? Yes. Now, why the transition to temple? Let's just think about this. David wants to build a temple. Oh, and incidentally, there's another useful story that you should know. It took 7 years to build the temple. It took 13 years to build the royal palace. All right, Solomon is big on public works projects. Really big. Why is this significant? Because up until this time, the tent was mobile. It could move around with the people. And there was no palace. Why now the need or the desire for both a temple and a palace? What does it signify?
Permanency.
Permanency. They've moved from being, hopefully, an occupying force to being a dedicated, serious nation. And like every other nation, it would like a central point of government and a central point of religious focus. Hence, a temple and a palace. And as much as we might read into it that Solomon really kind of loved this palace and kind of like built it for himself, what's also on his mind? If he's a good public servant, this is not just my palace, this is the people's palace. It's kind of like, in theory, like Washington and the government there is our government. I said in theory, it's kind of like that. And so Solomon is building permanence for the future of the country. It's a big deal. All right, we go to 1 Kings 9. As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea which you have made before me. And that is a prayer where Solomon says that this temple would be a place where people would come to fellowship with God. And if there were times in the country's future that they departed from God, they went a different way. But if they returned to God, Solomon prayed, restore your people. Now this is interesting. Solomon recognizes that it's the tendency of people to stray, and so he already anticipates this in a prayer and says, at those times in the future, when and if our people stray from you. Now, it's not too hard a stretch. Remember, he's not that many generations removed from the wandering in the wilderness. So he's well acquainted with the stories of the fact that, yeah, people are people. Yeah, the people of God, in fact, they actually do kind of stray. So we really need to pray about this, and we need to take this to God. And so he petitions God and says, When the people realize the errors that they've made and they turn back to you, let this be the place and let your forgiveness, let them find forgiveness and restoration here. At the permanent place. So what's he saying? Come on, bring me some of this. What's he saying?
I'm not going anywhere even if you are.
And so what he's saying is, don't let this nation be destroyed. We have built a permanent place where you and the people can interact, and when the people turn back to you, please heal them and restore them. How many of you want your life's work to be destroyed? How many of you hope that your legacy is that? Solomon's sensitive to that. David was sensitive to that. We're all sensitive to that. Remember what kind of story we're telling? We're telling the exception story. I'm somehow different. Thus far, Solomon has just addressed the fact that the people of this generation are not so much different from the past generation. I'm making a big deal of this because Solomon himself is aware of the fact that we all think we're exceptions to the rule, but he knows that every generation is going to have the same tendency to stray from God. And as for you, if you will, and this is God, let me just back up. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever. As I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. And the house that I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. And Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the people. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss. And they will say, what has the Lord done this? Why has the Lord done thus in this land and to this house? And they will say, because they abandoned the Lord their God who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and laid hold on other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all disaster on them. Okay. We'll go over to 1 Kings 11. Incidentally, the text here makes a big deal of the fact that God visited with, or Solomon received a vision from, a communication from God on two occasions. This was the second of them. So it's not implying that this was a regular thing where we might say, well, God, I felt God wanted me to, or I got the impression that. There were two very specific times that the text singles out and said God came to have fellowship and communion with Solomon at this specific time on this occasion for this reason. So this is not just the kind of like we do where we say God told me. This is a very real deal. So if God was able to communicate with Solomon at that level and he was able to give him this warning, how serious should Solomon have been about listening to it? And that's the point. Here we are, verse 11. Now Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughters of Pharaoh. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite woman, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your hearts after their God. Okay, so in order to make this clear so that you really do believe this is communication from God, let's go back to Deuteronomy 17th chapter. Because when you read this, it's pretty clear. Maybe this is one time and I wish I had a an electronic device, because you're probably already there.
This is some sad portions of scripture, really. Solomon did not finish well. No, correct.
Here we are. We're going to start at the 14th verse, 17th chapter in Deuteronomy. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it, and you dwell in it, then say, I will set a king over me like the nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You shall not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Now here we start to get into the conditions. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. All right, the next part is particularly important. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of the law approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them. All right, so all the difficulties of writing at that time aside, okay, the fact that because Solomon is king, we're going to discount some of them. In other words, Solomon didn't have to go out and make his own tablets or parchment. Solomon didn't have to create his own ink and his own, right? Let's assume that Solomon just pointed to this guy and that guy and said, bring me something to write on. Or maybe Solomon said, as a matter of fact, I don't feel like writing today. I've got a cramp in my wrist. Why don't you write? How long do you suppose it would take to write from Genesis, the beginning, to Deuteronomy, the end? Do you think that by the time you were done with that, you would have a more serious understanding of the Scriptures personally and intimately? Would you acquire thoughts along the way as you were writing? Would you discover things that perhaps you thought you knew, but it turned out you didn't know them quite the way they were said? In other words, if you were to go through this process, and you notice what this says, for every single king of Israel, this is to be his personal practice, to write his own copy of the book of the law, and then to study it. And it even goes so far as to say that this copy that he writes for himself has to be taken from one that is approved by the Levitical priest. In other words, you can't just invent your own version. You're going to copy one that's been approved for it. What would that do to your understanding of how to govern and lead? Do you see some of the things that God proscribed here? Don't do these things. Make sure that the kings of Israel don't do these things. Don't acquire many horses. Why? What's the horses thing about?
Not going back.
Okay, it's not only about not going back. They're going to have to acquire the horses from somewhere because they're not a people of horses.
Power.
It's power. Where are you going to derive your power? What are you going to trust in? Are you going to become a military force, and are you going to be trusted for your military? Are you going to trust in your military power? Now remember, one of God's missions for his people was that they would in some ways be different and distinct. And that's why when you see the opulence of what Solomon built, the opulence of the palace, the opulence of the temple, when you see it, at first blush you might think, wow, that's extravagant. And why would God even sanction that kind of building? But it seems that God gave Solomon free rein to build even what we would call extravagantly, because it was his intent that this nation would be an example of what the people of God could be if they followed his ways and his laws. If you remember the account of how the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon, and in the end, right before she leaves, and they've exchanged gifts, and she's been, you know, she's had all the oohs and ahs moments, and she says, they told me all about you, and about your wisdom, and about this place. They told me all about that. And she even goes into the detail describing his household servants, and the way the meals are served, and the quality of the food. The quality of the food. In that day, the quality of food was a big deal. She says, I heard all about this. And first, I didn't believe it. But secondly, when I got here, what I discovered is that the description wasn't the half of what I actually saw. That's how amazing this was. In other words, what Solomon started to do really did make an impression on the people. But there was one telling point in what the queen noticed. She didn't say, "Your God is amazing." The implication was, "You're pretty amazing." That's the exception in reverse. And what we're seeing there is Solomon started to take seriously his exceptionism, not his exceptionalism. Back to the text in chapter 11 of 1 Kings. Now Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughters of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, who were princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. And I believe this text right here is, we'll say, charitable to Solomon. His heart was not totally sold out to God. So let's read on so that we can see that. "For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Moloch, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all the foreign wives who made offerings and sacrificed to their gods." So do you start to get the picture? So here in Jerusalem we have a temple. But what's going on in the hills all around where all the people of Jerusalem and also all the people, remember Jerusalem's the capital. Who comes to the capital? Anybody who has business with the government. Who comes to the capital? Every tribe who has to pay tribute to the capital. Their form of taxes. Who comes to the capital? In one form or another, almost every single male adult. Because where's the worship done? At the temple. Where are the taxes and the tributes paid to? The capital. Everyone has to pass by. Ooh, that wasn't there last year. When did that get there? What is that? Okay, make this exceedingly practical. So it's not just Solomon's heart that's being turned as much as he doesn't understand that. It's the heart of the entire nation that's being turned. How much respect do you think the people had for Solomon initially? What do you suppose happens when Solomon starts to turn and starts to, we'll say, do some different public works projects?
Well, the key, when you're not totally surrendered, look what can happen. Just that word, well, I'm not totally surrendered to the Lord. I got this, look what can happen. Now you're playing it out.
All right, so ultimately, Solomon comes to the end of his days, and his son is going to take over. Now, I want you to see how things have played out. And toward the end of his life, and I would say not just the last couple of years of his life, but for the last number of years of his life, Solomon's leadership has been more about himself and his pleasure than it has about the good of the people. We're going to look at a key thing that gives us an indication of that. Rehoboam, who is Solomon's son, went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. Where does the President of the United States become president?
Washington.
Yeah, it's not a trick question. Right. Logically speaking, where should Rehoboam become king?
Jerusalem.
Why does Rehoboam need to go out to Shechem, which is in one of the, we'll call it the provinces? Why does Rehoboam need to go out to an outlying province to become king? Think about this. The people are starting to become uncomfortable with the type of leadership that they've experienced under Solomon. They're not sure if they want any part of Jerusalem anymore. They're not sure if they want this type of leadership. By the time Solomon is old, he is probably overworked and overtaxed and overabused his country.
Can I interject this? Because within the list you listed and the word does, all those other peoples and nations and their gods, and you go back when they first came into the land of Canaan, really the evil that this worship was. Temple prostitutes, male and female prostitutes. Molech, they took their babies and they threw them and sacrificed them into the fire to their god. And all of this evil upon evil upon evil. Not just, oh, I have another god. There's the evil perversion of the worship of those gods. And now the holy city of Jerusalem is polluted and filthy spiritually.
In other words, what he's saying is, while Joshua and the people immediately after him spent their time cleansing the land of all this, fighting to get it out of the land, Solomon hasn't just fought the fight and lost. Solomon is literally welcomed back in and built up what previous generations had given their lives to removing.
Yes.
That's how quickly this is all turned. And so when Rehoboam has to go outside the capital to see if, you ready for this? He can have the approval and the sanction of the people to be their leader. There might not inherently be anything wrong with that. But there wasn't any debate about should Solomon be king for the most part. The people were all behind Solomon. If Solomon had been a great leader from beginning to end, what should have been the likely result for Rehoboam?
He'd have been called to be king.
He'd have been called to be king. Please, your father did such a great job, and he's probably done a great job with you as well, raising up you, and you've probably learned leadership at his feet. Would you please be our leader? Wouldn't that be a logical response? See, this small, subtle phrase reveals just exactly how disenfranchised and upset and hurt and disappointed the people were. All right, so we'll read on. And as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it... Okay, so Jeroboam had worked for Solomon. Jeroboam had been thrown out of the kingdom and he ran for his life to Egypt. So as soon as he finds out that Solomon's gone, he comes back because he has a following. Jeroboam returned from Egypt and they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, and here we have it, your father made our yoke heavy. Now this is the citizens. I want to remind you, this is not the slave labor force. This is not the outside nations that perhaps had been recruited and commissioned to serve as slaves. This is the citizens of the country. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And he said to them, go away for 3 days and then come again to me. So the people went away. Now we all know this story, but we'll read it again anyway. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive. What do you see there? See, Rehoboam is sort of doing the right thing. He wants to write a story for his future, and what does he do? He immediately starts to consult people. I might not be wise enough to make the decision. Let me consult some of you. But, how do you advise me to answer this people? And they, that is the people who are older, more mature, perhaps had worked under his father, and they said to him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them, when you answer them, they will be your servants forever. But he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, what do you advise that we answer this people who have said to us, lighten your yoke and your father that your father put on us? And the young man who had grown up with him said to him, thus shall you speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus shall you say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's thigh. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So what does Rehoboam learn from all that? Let's come back to the timeline. And we'll keep drawing this because there's so much that's important in it. There's where Rehoboam is, and let's say he's got many years as an adult left to live. When he consults people of a short history, and he's going to build his future on people who have very little history, what do they know about what it's like to enslave people? They don't know anything about it. They know only one thing. If we extract from the people, we get richer. What do the old people know about what it means to lead people? The people with more history, what do they know? If I'm harsh, if I'm brutal with people, they're probably going to revolt. This is why we said again and again that despite the lie that you might tell yourself that if you're past a certain point, you can't build a great future, yes, you can, because you have more experience and more understanding on which to build a better future than a younger person with less experience and less wisdom. You still can build a fantastic future even if you don't feel that you've had a good time up until now. So I want to wrap this up with a couple of things. Where does Solomon go wrong? Because we can lay at Solomon's feet, I believe, this dialogue that takes place between Rehoboam and the people. There's no question about it. As a matter of fact, God even says that this is what's going to happen. But take that prophecy out of the equation for a moment and just look at human consequence. Who's ultimately to blame for the mess that Rehoboam walks into where the people are already in a sort of a mini-revolt? At what point in time does the wisest man who ever lived believe that he's above the law and above the God whom he entreated years before to help him lead this people? Because that was his first prayer. Your people are so numerous, your people are so many, and I'm so young, I need your wisdom and your guidance to lead these people well. And yet by the end of his life, it seems as if Solomon has concluded that he is above all that and he is the exception to the rule.
Start believing his own press
statement. Yes, exactly. Final thought. If one of the wisest men who ever lived can fall prey to that trap, then what do you suppose are our chances if we're not careful?